Greetings, everyone, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Look for us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, a healthcare market research firm. I'm also a member of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of today's program, which is entitled Medical Innovation: How Can We Get the Right Technology at the Right Price? There is, of course, widespread concern about the high cost of healthcare in America, and medical technology is often fingered as a major culprit. Our life sciences industry creates a remarkable pipeline of new drugs, devices, and diagnostics, but these come at a substantial cost. Are we getting our money's worth? Could we be smarter purchasers of medical innovation? Here today to address these questions is James Robinson, the Leonard D. Schaefer Professor of Health Economics, the head of the Division of Health Policy and Management, and the chair of the Berkeley Center for Health Technology at the University of California at Berkeley. Jamie is one of the nation's leading health policy experts. Back in 2007-2008, he took a year away from UC Berkeley to serve as editor-in-chief of Health Affairs, arguably the nation's leading health policy journal, where he remains a contributing editor. He also sits on the board of directors of the Integrated Healthcare Association. Jamie has particular expertise in insurance coverage, medical management, and payment methods for biomedical technology. He's authored more than 100 articles in scientific and policy journals and has published 3 books. The most recent of these, released just a few months ago, is entitled Purchasing Medical Innovation: The Right Technology for the Right Patient at the Right Price. And Jamie will be signing copies of the book or book plates immediately following today's session out in the lobby. This question of whether Americans pay too much for medical technology is complex and contentious. Jamie has a deep understanding of this issue and is noted for his balanced analysis of the problem and its possible solutions. So at this point, please help me welcome Professor Jamie Robinson.
Thank you, Mark, and I'm certainly grateful to be here and to see all of you, and extend my also thanks to the Commonwealth Club, and also to I'm representing the Berkeley Center for Health Technology, but also the University of California. So if you pay taxes in California, I work for you, and thank you very much on the part of the university. I've been a professor for Berkeley now for 30 years, so I have been around, seen a lot of change, but I've really gotten focused a lot in the past number of years on medical technology, by which I mean drugs, devices, diagnostics, the stuff of healthcare. And as Mark said, this is all wonderful stuff, but this is expensive stuff. So I'm actually going to start with a little show of hands. If there was two challenges facing the U.S. healthcare system, and it was up to you, which one should we focus on? One challenge is we don't have effective treatments for a lot of diseases, for HIV, for breast cancer, for multiple sclerosis. We don't have good treatments for people with congenital heart defects or spine conditions. So we need more innovation. That's one challenge or problem or whatever. And the other is, oh, my God, healthcare costs too much. It's breaking the budget of Medicare and Medicaid. Our employers are suffering. All of us pay as individuals. So if it was up to you, how many would say, should we focus our energies on more innovation or on reducing the cost of healthcare? Just a show of hands. Innovation, okay? Affordability and reducing the cost of healthcare. Well, that was about an equal split, and I really think that is that's a little bit the way I think about it. Depending on the day, I'm like flipping this way or I'm flipping that way. And the where I land on this what drives this book is as a partial solution to the how do we do both innovation and affordability is to make sure that we're using this stuff on the right patient, at the right time, in the right setting, and at the right price. Because we have a lot of great technology, but we use it in a lot of pretty foolish and sloshy ways. That's a scientific term. So the way that I think about this, the way the book is structured, is to think about what is the process of purchasing medical technology. And in my brain and in the book, it's really a four-part sequence. If you want to think, if a new drug or device from the laboratory to the patient has to go through or over four different hoops. And those are, first of all, it's got to get onto the market through the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Then, realistically, it's got to be approved by the insurers, by Medicare or the private insurers, because most of this stuff is so expensive that if you have to pay for it out of pocket, you're not going to use it, realistically. So the second stage is the insurance coverage policy. The third is the providers, the doctors, the hospitals, and the other caregivers. They have to prescribe it. They have to purchase it. We might think of them as providers, but if you're a drug or a device company, you think of them as buyers. They are buying your stuff and then using it on the patients. And they're big purchasers of care. If you work in the hospital industry, you know what I'm talking about. And then the final is you and me. It's the individual consumer. We all now face increasingly amounts of cost sharing in our health insurance. We have to pay out of pocket for more of our care directly. And then, of course, indirectly, we pay for it all one way or the other. We're taxpayers. If our employer pays for our health insurance, realistically, they're spending money that otherwise they could give us as part of our salary. Indirectly, we're paying for all this stuff. How sophisticated are we? What do we know? And so my view on all of this is that the U.S. healthcare industry, the supply side of the industry, I'm an economist, is the drug and device and diagnostics company. They're sophisticated. They really are. The stuff that they produce, it's mind-bending. You see it on TV or whatever. Some of the stuff you just kind of go, unbelievable. But the demand side of the market, the insurers, the hospitals, the consumers, historically have been much less sophisticated and much more conflicted in their incentives about buying right, buying smart. And so the book is all about, the hope of the book is to elucidate this complicated situation and to lead to improvements in a more rational thing. So that, therefore, to help with the stuff's good, but let's use it wisely. And so I'm going to just take about 10 minutes here to give an overview, and then Mark is going to, he's got some questions, and then you all are going to be solicited to provide your questions, and then we'll have a little interactive thing. So and I've got some notes that I brought along, and I won't dwell on them exceptionally. But anyway, to me, what is the value of a therapy? What is the value? How much, and therefore, like from an economist view, how much should we pay for this stuff? Right? Well, the value of it depends on what I call its clinical value and its economic value. The clinical value of a drug, a new drug, it's partly the molecule. I mean, this, Genentech or whoever, they develop these molecules. It's really unbelievable. It's the molecule. But in addition, the effectiveness of this molecule and therefore the clinical value of it depends on which patient is it used on, first of all. We know that a lot of people, about 50% of the people that are administered a drug don't respond to that drug because they have a different genetic makeup or the disease is more complicated. So we have a lot of this stuff is being given to the wrong patient. Some patient people are getting drugs they shouldn't be taking. Other people are not being given drugs they should be taking. It also depends on what is the other aspects of the care? Is the drug being given at the right time? Is it in the right combination? Is the patient collaborating with it? Does the patient know when and how to take it? And then that certainly goes also for surgery. If you're a candidate for surgery, surgery is really amazing. It really is amazing what they can do. But the patient has a big role in being prepared for that and being active to keep yourself strong, keep yourself healthy, get up afterwards to the extent possible and really get exercising. You go up to UCSF or somewhere. I like to watch surgery. You see knee replacement surgery or hip replacement surgery. You know what they do with hip replacement surgery? They go in there with power saws. They cut the patient open. They got a power saw. It looks like the kind of thing you rip a board with. They cut off the top of your thigh bone, and they're wearing big masks. There's bits of bone and blood is just like flying. I mean, it is like really. And then they go in and they put this artificial thing and they got to wedge it into the bone. So the surgeon's got this mallet and he hits it like this. These surgeons are strong. They are. Okay? I mean, they're like hit. I mean, like that. Okay? They do that all day long. And so the poor patient, and then they put this, sew the patient back up together. They wheel him out of there. and that patient is up and walking around that same day. That same day, that patient, they're mostly old people, elderly people, are up and walking. And they should be, because that's what really keeps that gets them back going again, gets starts the healing. It's not lying in bed. It's the active participation of the patient. And if they don't do that, they have a worse outcome. And I know that because my father fell down, broke his hip, emergency, had emergency hip replacement, great, as far as we could tell, great surgery, but he was not a good patient. He did not do all that stuff. The only thing he really liked was Vicodin, okay? My dad, he's had about 300 peer-reviewed publications, speaks five languages, and he could tell you, I've got 17 and a half minutes till my next Vicodin dose, you know? So he didn't get up, so he had a bunch of series of complications. It was his fault. I have to, you could say it's my fault for not whacking him with a stick, but whatever. Anyway, so that's. Anyway, back to the point of the book. The process of assessment and purchasing, the FDA, we usually don't think of as a purchaser. The FDA is a gatekeeper for new drugs, new devices, and new tests. But it plays a very important role in deciding what's going to come on the market, and it faces this trade-off between the more it requires a new technology to go through testing on safety and on efficacy to protect the consumer, the longer the delay is, the higher the cost is for the developer, and then one way or another, that's going to result in very high-cost drugs and high-cost devices. And some of them never make it to the market at all. The vast majority of new drugs in the pipeline and new devices never make it onto the market because the manufacturer knows, they estimate what's the potential sales of this, and they say the cost of it is going to be so high, we're going to lose money on this, we're going to abandon this drug early on. Okay. And so the FDA is struggling with how do we reduce the barriers to getting things onto the market? So stuff should get onto the market faster, but also make it easier to get stuff off the market faster we should keep monitoring and surveillance. If it does prove to be either less effective or more toxic than we had thought. Often it's for subpopulations. A good example of this is there's a drug called Tysabri. It's incredibly effective against patients with multiple sclerosis. If you know anything about multiple sclerosis, it is a nasty, horrible disease. And up until very recently, the treatments were just really ineffective. Tysabri was incredible effects on patients. But for a very small percentage of the patients, it caused a rare but very serious brain cancer. Okay, very serious. So the FDA pulled it off the market, and then they had to find a way to make it safe to get it back on the market for the patients that weren't going to get brain cancer, but who still had multiple sclerosis. So the FDA, and the book we get into that in more detail of how to wrestle with that, to not either overregulate or underregulate. And the FDA gets a lot of grief from both sides. There's some people that say the FDA is crimping innovation by preventing new drugs from getting on the market. Those people are not just pharmaceutical industry people. Those people are also AIDS advocacy groups, breast cancer advocacy groups are saying patients should have the right to try this stuff even if it hasn't been proven. And then on the other side, we have people concerned, oh my God, there's toxic stuff on the market. How do we deal with that? So that's the FDA. And I actually think the FDA has been doing, I'm actually a fan of the FDA. It's hard for it now in America to get up and say anything about a government bureaucracy that's positive. But actually the FDA has been doing a fabulous job despite continual harassment by Congress. I mean, absolute horrible harassment. Anyway, talking about the insurers, and actually I'm going to accelerate this. I want to get it right back right to Mark. And I'm going to go, the insurers have a role, the doctors and hospitals have a role, and the book spends a lot of time on that, but I actually want to wrap this up with the role of the consumer. Because back in the day, we thought of the individual, the patient, as a patient, sort of the passive recipient of care, and now increasingly, love it or leave it, the patient is a part of the team. The effectiveness of the treatment depends on the consumer being educated, informed, and in America, willy-nilly, the patient is paying for this stuff more and more out of pocket. And this has both good and it's got bad. Because what we know is that patients, people, consumers, want too much of the wrong stuff and not enough of the right stuff. That's the fact, one. Okay, we have massive over-medication and over-demand, excessive demand out there for a lot of unproven therapies, toxic therapies. This is both sort of lifestyle drugs, but it's also end-of-life treatments and the family that won't let the patient go, or et cetera. It's really terrible. People want to try all this stuff. They want to have all these tests that are just, I mean, a lot of this genomic testing, people should not have these tests. They're not good tests yet, okay? And not everybody should be tested for everything all the time, because then you find that all of us are carrying in all kinds of anomalies in our bodies, you know? We just are blissfully ignorant, and we're going to live our 4 score and 10 years, and those anomalies are still going to be there the whole time. We're not going to die of them. But if you go in there and start looking and screening, you start seeing these things. And then we need to do more tests, and then we need a biopsy, and then we do an intervention, and you know, back surgery is the best example of this. Horrible back surgery. Terrible. So anyway, there's over-demand, but there's also under-demand. There's so many people, only about half the people out there that have got diabetes, that have got hypertension, are taking the right medications for this thing. And those medications now are cheap. They really are. The generic drugs, they're really effective, and they're really underutilized. And it's mind-boggling. Diabetic patients, untreated diabetes leads to all kinds of really horrible things, like they amputate your feet. You go blind. Stuff like that. You kind of go, ooh. Why don't I take a $4 a month generic drug that I got from Target to prevent that? And, you know, so motivating the patient, and it's not just the doctor can't do it all. We don't have enough doctors. They're too expensive, and the patients have to be in, and the community, the family, it's partly a cost sharing thing. We need intelligent cost sharing, that we pay more for stuff that works worse or doesn't work. And we pay less for stuff that does work. You know, financial incentives, love it or leave it, are pretty effective. People do respond to incentives. A lot of my work at Berkeley is looking at how consumers respond to if this is cheap, they do that. If that's more expensive, they don't do that. That people that works in healthcare as well as in the rest of life. And America is really different from a lot of other like European countries in that we do have a lot more consumer-driven, consumer-oriented incentives, and we struggle with those, and we do that poorly. But we're not going to get away from it completely. So we have to redesign it. And as you know, if you follow Obamacare and the health insurance exchanges, there's more and more cost sharing out there. There's more and more. So I want to just wrap this up before I turn it back to Mark and say, what are the implications of this for the drug and device and diagnostics companies? And they have been, if I may describe it as such, they probably wouldn't see it this way, but they've been living in the golden age. They've been living in an age where, I mean, the FDA has always been difficult, but the insurers and the providers and the consumers have been what I call the field of dreams. If you develop some new treatment, we'll cover it, we'll pay for it, we'll prescribe it, we'll swallow it. That's why the U.S. has the highest healthcare costs in the world. We just love this stuff, and we just swallow it, and we pay for it. And there's both good and bad in that. And now they're dealing with a much increasingly sophisticated and penny-pinching demand side. The insurers are getting tougher. They're getting tougher on cancer drugs as well as on everything else. They're getting tougher, and the providers are. The hospitals and doctors are getting much more. The book talks about that a lot, the strange financial incentives facing the physicians and the hospitals in terms of who should get surgery and what kind of device, and, you know, our hip replacement example. Well, which hip? Okay, there's manufacturers of the hips. They're in there. You go into the UCSF, go into, you know, any hospital, walk up the street and you go to St. Francis. Walk into the emergency room, sort of get scrubbed, and get in there, and you see there's the surgeons, and then there's nurses, and then there's other people in there. They work for technology companies. They're in there advising the doctors and selling this stuff. They're in there all the time. It's relentless. It's absolutely relentless, and yet that's changing. So anyway, how can we manage all that? The technology companies have to adopt to a world where they have a more sophisticated purchaser. And I believe from a God's eye view, and of course I do stand on the right hand of God because I'm a professor, that that this is good for them in the long run. It's good for an industry to have sophisticated consumers that really understand the technology of what they're using and really know what can differentiate good from bad, because that's the incentive to create a good, effective drug, is that a good, effective drug, you'll sell more of it and at a higher price than a less effective drug, a more toxic drug. And that's the incentive for them to invest in stuff that really works. So I want to wrap that up and turn it right back to Mark, who's going to ask me some really soft and easy questions.
Oh, no way. First, let's thank Jamie Robinson.
While we are discussing, please do feel free to put some questions on cards. You can pass them up this way. Also want to take this opportunity to remind our listening audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, and my guest is UC Berkeley professor and health policy expert Jamie Robinson. We're talking about how we can pay for medical innovation. So, Jamie, I want to start with the key issue you framed up front. There's a concern that medical technology costs too much. Okay, so let me frame both sides of the argument, the extremes. How about that? And you can comment on it. So on the one hand, critics would say that when you think about medical technology, and let's focus on pharmaceuticals since that's the most visible and the largest piece of that, that they sure cost a lot. Look at some of the prices. Some of them are in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Other countries seem to pay a lot less for many of the same drugs. How can that be in America? We find that certainly many would claim that the pharmaceutical industry marketers spend a lot of money on very aggressive and sometimes unethical marketing practices, trying to get us to take more expensive drugs than we need, more drugs than we need, or even drugs that we don't need. You put all that together and you say, boy, that's pretty bad. We're paying a lot for these drugs and we don't really need them all. The other extreme is this. People would say, well, wait a minute. When you look at everything we spend on healthcare, doctors, hospitals, dentists, nursing homes, drugs, building hospitals and so forth, the percentage we spend on drugs is only 9.3%. And that's down from 4 years earlier when it was 10.2%. Pretty small amount, right? At the same time, if you look over the last 10 years and what we would hope for the next 10 years, almost all the true meaningful improvements in our ability to treat diseases come from medical technology. Right, doctors aren't really better than they were 10 years ago in terms of just being better people or more skilled. Hospitals aren't better managed. And 10 years from now, if we are able to treat diseases we can't currently treat effectively, and we believe we will be able to, that's almost all because we're going to have better technologies. We're going to have medical innovation. So we don't spend much on it. It's the lion's share of the improvement. Don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg by putting some kind of constraints on it. So those are the two extremes, Jamie. Which one is right?
Well, I have to read the book to get the answer to that. But I think what do I think will happen?
Okay.
All right. So my fear is that the cost problem has become so severe that we risk in the U.S. developing methods of physician payment, consumer insurance benefit designs, and other instruments that will meaningfully restrict patients' access to effective care. Some patients' access to effective care, and that indirectly will weaken the incentives to invest in research and development. So I think that in the past I would have said it's the opposite problem, is that we had the field of dreams, and we were very flabby in our assessment and purchasing of technology, and it was anything goes, and now we are risking going in the other direction.
In terms of too much restrictiveness?
Yeah, particularly for some conditions and some patients. Now, there will always be... there will always be overutilization out there, but I am concerned about the evidence. Like for cancer treatments, for example, it's really remarkable. People are paying a lot now for cancer drugs. Some people, and therefore going without it. And yet, you say, how is it possible that people with lung cancer are not taking the, there's some of them are not oral cancer drugs, not taking their oral cancer drug they've got because it costs much out of pocket. Well, they got lung cancer, but they do that. So
here's the challenge, and of course the challenge is always going to be we want to have the right innovation, and we don't want to spend money on things that are not the right innovation. You know, overall, if I could characterize the problem, more broadly than just technology, but that's a big piece of it, is collectively we as a society want to consume more healthcare than we collectively want to pay for. That's kind of fair. So in my mind, the only way to navigate that somehow, if we're not just going to keep paying whatever, is that at some point in some instances we have to say no. If that's true, who should say no? Should it be the government? Should it be insurance companies? Should it be individual doctors, patients, hospitals? Who should say no?
Okay. Well, that's the big question in health policy. Where is the no? Okay. And there's really five candidates. There's the government in different ways. There's employers in an employment-based system the way we have now. There are insurance companies. There's the doctors. And there's the consumers, or the patients. That's the way I have five. The question is of those. And if you look at European countries, many of them, the government is doing the heavy lifting. The government controls what gets on the market, sets prices, and then within that, the consumers are not paying much out of pocket. The doctors are paid in a way that don't really incentivize them one way or another. And the insurance company is the government, really, and the employers are out of the picture. So it's really the government. The U.S. system really doesn't do that, and I think we'll do it less and less. And I just think it's a cultural thing. I think that America is historically and to this very day a culture that is skeptical of a strong role of the government that ebbs and flows and it rises and it falls depending on whether we're in a war or not, you know, and all that kind of a thing. But all things considered, I don't see any trend towards people saying, this stuff costs too much. I want single-payer health care. I mean, in San Francisco they do, and in Vermont. But if you take those two places out of the picture, they don't. And so we're stuck with some combination of the others.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of go through the list. And the others have all waded into that and thought that they could solve it. The employers, that was called managed care, and they were all going to do all this stuff. And the insurers, and they found that telling consumers that they couldn't have what they wanted or they couldn't see the doctor that they wanted or the test or the drug got them a lot of grief, a lot of bad publicity, a lot of employee dissatisfaction, a lot of litigation, a lot of regulation. And they've decided that they don't want the job. Employers, despite many of us in policy wonk land say, oh, the employers should, you know, push the system along. The employers don't want to do it. They don't want to have their employees annoyed about the doctor or the drug or the whatever. And, you know, the reality is Americans are we're all very rights conscious, and we demand, you know, our fair share of unnecessary and inappropriate medical care. Right? And we don't want our employer telling us no.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want our insurance company telling us no. All right? So next candidate is the doctor. The doctors, they go to medical school not to tell people they don't need treatment. They go to medical school, they come out of medical school to treat people. Now, they're smart and they understand that there's excessive care and inappropriate care, and a lot of very intelligent, thoughtful physicians, of course, out there. But at the end of the day, they really will tell patient, you shouldn't do this if it's toxic or ineffective. But the doctor doesn't want to sit there and say, this stuff would help you, but you can't afford it, so don't do it. I mean, they don't want to do what we call bedside cost-effectiveness analysis, right? And they basically want to do more, not less, and they're not interested. And so you can pay them capitation or something, and it gives them some incentives, but at the end of the day, they kind of resist it. That leaves so I think who's left? The consumer. And so I think that the person, where the no is happening is going to be at the consumer level. And I call it consumerism by default. It's because nobody else wants to do it. Mm-hmm. It's got some real strengths because consumers making choices for themselves is a good thing. I mean, probably all of us being Americans kind of think that individual choice is a good thing, informed choice. I don't want paternalism. I don't want the doctor making my choices for me. I don't want the government making my choices for me. I don't want my employer or my insurance company telling me what I can do. I'll listen to whichever, advice, and then I'll do what the internet tells me or something like that. And so that's all good, but, of course, consumers are ignorant and uninformed. Many of them are passive. Some of them are depressed. Frankly, some of them are sick, and people when they're sick are not the best decision makers necessarily, right? So to dump this all on the consumer, But anyway, I think it's the consumer. That's what I think we're driving ever more into a consumer-centric system, and that's got good things to it and bad things to it, but it's happening.
So let's say that we had what we don't have, which is a perfectly designed healthcare system. Everything's extraordinarily well managed, okay? Now, in that case, would new technologies, would that increase costs anyway because we're doing more stuff?
That's a very good point. You say, well, okay, Jamie, you just wrote this book about how we can tune up the purchasing of healthcare and the assessment and purchasing. What if, against all the evidence, people actually took your advice and actually did all this stuff, and we got rid of the waste and the slosh of healthcare? And that's a very good question. And I think that's a two-part answer. What innovation in medical technology and forms of care does typically is it reduces the cost of doing the things we have been doing. Okay? Like a knee replacement surgery is a lot cheaper than it used to be. They know how to do much more microscopic. They get in there. There's much less morbidity. They really do it a lot better and cheaper than they used to. It used to be you would be in the hospital for weeks, and now you're out of the hospital in 2 days, and that's really cheaper. So that reduces cost. But then once costs are cheaper and outcomes are better, then more people want it, and we do it on more people. Yeah. And that raises the cost. And the net effect of those, you say, well, which is the net? Okay, part of it is this reducing cost. Which is the net? The net is cost increasing. That this expansion of the scope of care for the past 50 years has dominated the cost-reducing part of innovation that actually made things cheaper. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't been due to waste or anything. That's been due to – and so my guess is that costs will continue to rise. But if we do it right, they will continue to rise at a slower pace. And we'll get more for our money. That's our goal is value, is getting more for your money, not necessarily spending less. I personally don't have a problem America spending more than it's spending on healthcare right now, so long as it's getting more, real more. Like hepatitis C, for example. Mm-hmm. That's the Sovaldi drugs. Everybody heard about that. $84,000, $1,000 a pill. It's like that's the blockbuster, budget buster of the day. Mm-hmm. And expensive. But the reality is that this drug and the ones, its imitator drugs, are going to cure hepatitis C for a large part of the population. And at least that part of the population that actually takes the drug. I mean, that's a whole nother topic. And that's going to be that's going to be a huge advance of public health. And it's going to offset costs of other kinds. And it's going to be a wonderful thing. It's going to be a wonderful thing. And, 50% of people in prison in America are Hep C positive. 50%. Okay. It's a huge deal. It is a huge deal. If you get, by the way, if you get, don't break the law. There's a lot of good reasons not to break the law. But one of the reasons not to break the law is not to go to jail. And one of the reasons not to go to jail is to not get infected with Hep C. Okay. There you go. One more reason.
Yeah. It's a bad thing. Well, we, not surprising, did get a question about the views of the price of drugs, Sovaldi and Harvoni, and I think it's interesting because if you look at the pricing, they're not among the top 10 most expensive drugs, right? Of course, the most expensive drugs are for extremely rare conditions. So no one's talking about them much because those are life-saving drugs that a few thousand people in the whole country you want to have. I think that the problem of the pricing of Sovaldi when it first came out was the concern was it was so good that an awful lot of people who had actually been treated for hep C previously or didn't go through the treatment because the previous treatments had a lot of side effects would start to use it. So there was, in many ways, a victim of its own success. And the cost of it, which, of course, is the price times the number of people who use it, was just an extraordinary big bump for the healthcare system over a short period of time. But it does beg the question of how should breakthrough new drugs be priced? If we had a choice right now and someone said, a drug company said, we can cure breast cancer, people would say, fantastic. And the company said, but the price is going to be $200,000 a year. And people say, well, we're not going to pay that. They'd say, okay, we won't develop the drug. If we had that kind of a true stark comparison, what would we do? Would we want that or not? You'd be saving the cost of breast cancer treatment in the future, but you'd be paying it all in the year that people got breast cancer and so forth. These are the kinds of things that are hard, and our system isn't really set up to answer that question in a unified fashion.
That's right. We don't. In fact, we make that decision. Implicitly, we make the decision. The more we say, drug company, charge whatever you will, sell your drug to whoever you want, push your product, they make more money. You know what happens? More capital flows into the pharmaceutical industry. The venture capital companies put more money into the startups. The startup, they put more research. They give more grants to the University of California and other wonderful places. And that produces more treatments. Mm-hmm. That produces more treatments. And so the more we crimp on that, the more it discourages that. And the venture capitalists say, well, I'll put my money into, you know, the next iPhone generation or whatever, something of that nature. And so now I'm not, you know, it's tricky. You don't want waste. On the other hand, so anyway, also I want to say something about the price. The price of a drug should be thought of as not the price at any one moment in time, but the price of the drug over the lifetime of the drug. Most drugs, they start on the market, they have the launch price, we call it launch price, is usually high. And then, and especially a drug like a Sovaldi, which doesn't have a competitor, and it's like a little bit of, it's a monopoly, they basically said, what is the absolute biggest number we could come up with before, you know, people scream? Well, they exceeded that a little bit in this one. Instead of $1,000 a pill, they should have had $877.42 a pill or something like that. People would have said, okay. But then competitors enter, and already with Sovaldi, there's multiple competitors. Now they have to discount. There's price warfare going on out there with the insurance companies and the PBMs. The average discount on Sovaldi is now 46%. So the price is not $1,000 a pill. It is $1,000 minus 46% in the United States of America. Okay, it's less than some other countries. They sell it in Egypt at a 99% discount. 99% discount. That's a discount. Okay, Egypt's got a lot of hepatitis C. Turns out. And then eventually these things go generic, and once they're generic, then the price even falls even further. And we have the good people down at Walmart selling this stuff for $4 a month. Or whatever, and then it's at that point you might as well just start giving this stuff away. Mm-hmm. And so, like aspirin. Aspirin, one of the greatest drugs ever discovered, hands down. It is aspirin, unbelievable. Unbelievable. And it's over the counter, and I don't even know what, it doesn't even cost a penny a pill probably, right, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You got to take all that into consideration. That over time, now, I am not an apologist for Gilead, the manufacturer of Sovaldi. They do not support my research, unfortunately. And I mean, I just don't know why. But anyway, I just want to say that curing hepatitis C is an amazing thing.
That's what we asked the industry to do that.
That's right. We'd rather do that. It's not just some Me Too drug, you know. It's a breakthrough.
But to say we can't really give a free pass either there.
That's right. That's right.
And overall, the incentives seem to be a bit messy. We have a good question here from a biomedical entrepreneur who says, in the U.S. there's really no incentive to create a device, for instance, that is 95% as good as anything on the market but costs 90% less. You know, like a much better buy, just not quite as good. And it reminds me, I read somewhere that the fighter jets that we fly in with our Air Force and so forth, 50% of the cost gets to 95% speed. And the other 50% of the entire cost gets 5% more. It's a little bit more. And, of course, if you're in a dogfight, that probably matters a lot because you die or you live. But we seem to have the same thing in healthcare where we're paying an awful lot to get a little bit better increment, and there's not an incentive for an entrepreneur who says, I can save you a lot of money. It won't be quite as good, but it'll be almost as good. What can we do about that, or will the way that we're asking patients to cost share do something about that?
We are moving in that direction. The two biggest changes that will affect that, which we'll call – what we want is, in the economic jargon, we need to create a price-conscious demand or cost-conscious demand. There's really two ways. That could be either on the doctor's side or on the patient's side. On the doctor's side, it comes through methods of physician payment, which say, okay, doctor and doctor hospital, here's your budget for the population, and you kind of live within that. And so if you buy the cheaper gadget, then you save money and you can spend that extra money on something else. Mm-hmm. Okay. And like on a knee replacement, there's about 8 companies that produce artificial knees, and you can bargain with them and you find the cheapest one and et cetera. Or make it for the patient. Okay, patient, you're paying a deductible. You've got you pay the first $2,000 or you pay 20%. The patient's interested. And so back to the question about there's no incentive to create a device that's 95% as good but a lot cheaper. Well, that depends on the sector, but that's really changing. Mm-hmm. There's people are really interested. Consumers are the ultimate cheap date. Oh, my God, when they're spending their own money on health care, they want the cheaper thing. When they're spending the insurance company's money, that's a whole different thing. Then it's a basic human right. Price is irrelevant, you know. But when they're spending their own dollar, they are very price conscious, and I think that there is an increasing market for what we call good enough technology. There's a regulatory challenge there because it's very hard to get the FDA or the market to have an EKG machine or an MRI machine which isn't quite at the specs. It's kind of like it's hard to build a house in San Francisco that isn't designed with the best engineering, you know, specs. You can't be a beach bum in San Francisco like in the good old days, you know, where you could just put your shack together and then, you know.
Doesn't work that way anymore. There's a couple of questions really about the public debate about all this. You know, there's been a lot of attempts to engage the public in more of a discussion about cost, not just their own cost, but general overall cost of health care. And everybody starts talking about rationing right away or death panels or something. That hasn't been very productive. And there's a related question about is it time for us to have a conversation about putting a price on human life? Of course, you might argue that we already do to whatever extent we make decisions saying it's going to cost more. In San Francisco, they made a decision a couple years back about whether they should add another ambulance to their fleet of the city ambulances. And they knew that they could tell you exactly how much it would cost and how many lives it would save. So there is a price tag there. But, of course, we don't really talk about that explicitly for the most part. So how can we better engage the public in the discussion of value in healthcare purchasing?
That's an excellent question. I think that although it's true that implicitly we are putting value on life and sort of like the ambulance example, I think that having a public debate about that is does not have value, mm-hmm. and would actually just create more venom and more mudslinging and more accusations, and it just wouldn't be helpful. I think that we should talk about reducing waste. There's enough waste. Let's start with the waste before we start worrying about the value of life. Okay, that's number one. And then let's encourage people to become more educated about the quality of life and the futility of some forms of care. Next week with your wife, there's going to be a discussion about end-of-life care. We spend a lot in America, a lot of money on care and people at the end of life. Some of that care is really good, but some of it really isn't prolonging life. It's prolonging death. And you could save a lot of money by spending less there, but I think the way to do it is not to say, oh, you know, we've already spent $200,000 on you, that's it. Or, you know, you're already 95 years old, that's it. It's rather just telling people about and the families. It's often the families, the heroics. We shouldn't be giving these horrible, toxic chemotherapies to patients that are within weeks of death. We just shouldn't do it. It's torture. It's really torture. And I think there's just a lot that can be saved in that, and we can get at a lot of that end of life and a lot of that. Same thing with infants, you know, the premature babies that are this big, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I think that we can get at, there's a good role for, you know, talking about ethics and the futility and quality of life. We've got so much to be gained there before we get into anything about, you know, what's the value of life.
Mm-hmm. About technology overall.
Yeah.
Gotcha. What do you think about the question is, what's your take on the on pharmacogenetic testing and other genetic testing and trying to better match? Is there a good opportunity for us to match drugs to the people who are most likely to respond and save money in that way?
Okay. That question is, this is a great example of technology generally. Now, one of the most incredible scientific breakthroughs over the past several decades has been understanding and being able to map the genome, the individual genome, and the price of that has plummeted. It used to be in the millions, millions, millions of dollars, and now it's below $1,000 to map the entire genome of a human, and it's just plunging. Now they are doing full genome scans on certain kinds of patients with certain kinds of cancers. They're not just looking for particular genetic aberrations. They're doing the whole goddamn thing, right? Because it only costs them about $900 or whatever, and that's going down. By, I mean, $900 was yesterday. I mean, like tomorrow it's $700, right? It's really, Moore's Law is really good. The dilemma there is that people say, well, I can now afford it. I want it. And then these tests create all these little – you've got all these little anomalies, which we don't really understand. And then people can get those tests, and then they say, well, then I need some more tests because, you know. And then maybe I need a biopsy. And then maybe I need this or maybe I need that. And that can really lead to a lot of unnecessary care, a lot of toxic care. And so I think that the our ability to produce high-quality, low-cost genetic tests has far outpaced our ability to interpret them and use them appropriately. And that's a cultural dilemma. And yet no insurance company or nobody's going to say, oh, no, you can't have that test. You know what I mean? It's like, who's going to say that? Or they might say, we're not going to pay for that genetic test, but then you go out and pay your own $500, you get the test. Then you come into your doctor and you say, wait a minute. This, you know, and then what's the doctor going to do? If the doctor just says, oh, you know, don't worry about it, that's like, you know, how's that going to sound if then you do get cancer and then the doctor gets sued and there's a jury of eighth grade dropouts there, and that sounds like you had the data right there. And, you know, so the doctor's going to say, well, yeah, let's what do you want to do? The doctor's, they're going to punt. Actually, that's what they're saying now. Is, well, what do you want to do? Kick it back to the consumer. I belong to Kaiser Permanente, and you know, some people are, oh, the HMO, they ration care. Oh no, my God, they don't. That's like, okay, here's your test. What do you want to do about that? Oh, do you want another test? I was like, whatever you want. You know, it's like,
isn't it great being an academic? You can say whatever you want, right, overall. Yeah. Well, the testing, the general testing is true. The joke in medical training is that the attending physician asks the intern, what's the definition of a healthy patient? And the intern says, someone who has not been sufficiently worked up.
That's right.
Because if you do enough tests, you find something wrong.
That's right. We're
but I will say in our work, we do a lot of research with insurance, kind of health insurers. There's a lot of talk about these tests because, first of all, there's a general sense if you hear about a genetic test, you say, great. And there's sort of an assumption that it's cost-free and it's perfect, okay? And both those assumptions are quite wrong. Most of these tests are thousands of dollars, and they're far from perfect. The sensitivity and specificity isn't completely accurate. So free and perfect is fine, but what if you're making a decision about the test is only 80% sensitive and it costs $2,000? Shouldn't an insurer pay for that? And if they do, and the results say that you won't benefit from that drug, but there's a 20% chance that it's wrong and you would, are you going to accept that? So because of these problems, insurers by and large are not paying for most of these drugs. And part of it is they say even a test that's more than 80% accurate, they don't believe that if the test says someone shouldn't get the drug, that the person will stop complaining until they get the drug. So therefore, they end up paying for the test, which says you shouldn't get the drug and the drug. Why not just pay for the drug? I'm serious. There was an experiment done. I talked to the chief medical officer of one of the largest health insurers in the country about this a year or two ago, and he started an experiment on cancer tests that had both the patient and the physician sign an agreement saying, if this test comes back and says you won't benefit from the drug, you won't ask for it. But when I checked back in with him a year later, he said they had abandoned that experiment. It was just too hard to enforce. So it goes back to your point about insurers are trying to put restrictions and they get a lot of grief for it. And by and large, we probably can't count on our health insurers to really make the kind of tough decisions because we as the public aren't supportive of that if they don't go our way.
But just to make a little a subtle distinction, there's two kinds of diagnostic tests that Mark and I were talking about, just so everyone got to the one type of screening test. That's what really I was talking about. Okay, you do your genome, you look around, and you rummage around in there. What do you find? And then you follow it up. Mark's talking about companion diagnostics. You've got colon cancer. We know that. Now we've got this drug, but we also know that this drug works on some patients but not on other patients, depending probably on a genetic characteristic. And then we've got this genetic test, which may or may not be very accurate. But even if it is accurate, and they're getting better, I mean, I'm very much in favor. Companion diagnostics is great medicine. We should not be using these drugs on patients who are not going to respond. If we can get tests, molecular tests or other tests, that differentiate, that is the best of medicine, right? But we do have to be able to and be willing to say, you know, assuming the test is good, if you are not a candidate, then we won't pay for it. That's a very touchy topic. Because partly the tests are not for 100% for sure, and then you know insurance companies they always lose in the media. You know, sympathetic mother, you know, wants her unnecessary and inappropriate medication. Sleazebag for-profit insurance company says that they won't pay for it. Who wins? Who wins?
Yeah, it's not worth the fight for them very much. Now, one of the approaches that you describe in your book is called value-based pricing. And we see that, for instance, most commonly, most people with commercial insurance have copays. And for categories such as diabetes, where everybody really wants people to take their medications, even for branded drugs that would normally be $25 or $50, people may only be charged a $10 copay or even no copay. Say, forget about copay. We want you to take the drugs so badly. So that sounds great. And it's being used by a small but growing number of insurers for diabetes and asthma products. Why can't we apply that on a wider basis?
Good point. Where, just to say what he's talking about is that we're all of us with health insurance are familiar with copays for drugs, right? And often tiered copays. You pay for these certain ones, you pay $10, others $25, $50 or more. And usually the level of your payment is linked to the price of the drug. If you choose a cheaper drug, you pay less. If you choose a more expensive drug, you pay more. But what's called value-based insurance design is to say, well, no, we should have the copay should be high if the drug is ineffective, regardless of its price, and the copay should be less if the drug is effective, once again, regardless of its price. And that has been used, as Mark pointed out, for some conditions like diabetes, where the insurers, everybody else finds that these people incomprehensibly are not taking their diabetes drugs because it costs them $10 a month. I mean, you know, it's like, how much are your feet worth? But, and so they say, well, we'll just give it to them. And that works well, but it hasn't been used that broadly. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is we need good criteria for what's a high-value use of a drug and what's a low-value use of a drug. And the doctors and the insurers are more comfortable with saying, actually, back to your genetic test, your companion diagnostic. If we think that this is a high value use of the drug, we're going to cover it. And if it's a low value use, we're not going to give it to you at all. We don't want to give it to you with a copay, a higher copay. We're just going to give it not at all. And we're sort of in this middle ground on that. And we need better metrics of what works and what doesn't work. And I think it's going to be more applied to – I think the level of cost sharing is going up. People out of pocket, deductibles, it's just like that. If you look at the statistics, it's just unbelievable now. The trend, everybody's paying more and more out of pocket. If you're not, you're in the favored few, it's just like going like that. And the question is, how can we offset that? The way to offset that is to say, if you've got a condition that for which there is a good course of care, like you're diabetic, and then you go into our diabetes disease management program and you do the things you're supposed to do, you watch your weight, you watch your, then we take away your cost share. You don't have to pay out of pocket. So it's not at the level of the drug, it's the level of the whole program. Okay? And I think that's the future, I think. So like cancer patients, you know. Mm-hmm. The biggest cost of cancer is not the drug. The biggest cost of cancer is unplanned hospital admissions due to patients getting toxicity from the drug or from the disease. Mm-hmm. And that they're unmanaged because they're ignorant, they're not adherent, or whatever. And they end up in the emergency room, then they end up in the hospital. Suddenly, forget the $2,000 a week drug, they're like, it's like $40,000 like that. Mm-hmm. Right? So managing that, having those patients really educated and informed is really the crux.
I'm glad you brought up a little more discussion about co-payments and cost sharing and tiers and so forth, since the average person is in a plan that pays, they don't have a first dollar, they don't have to hit their deductible before they get their pharmacy copay, so they're paying $25 or $50 or $75 or $10 or $4 for generics. Okay, so realistically then, let's say I could wave a magic wand and cut drug costs by 20%. I'd be an incredible hero, not in the drug industry, but, you know, in public policy circles, right? So now that drug that's $300 a month, but the individual's paying $25 a month, is 20% less. But the individual's still paying $25 a month, right? So if there was some way to rein in the cost of these technologies, would it actually accrue to the patient anyway?
Often the way benefits are set up, it doesn't. And then the pharmaceutical company or whoever we're talking about says, well, why should I reduce the price of my – I mean, the only reason that anybody in business ever reduces the price of what they're selling is to sell more of that. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason. And so if they don't sell more of it, why bother? I mean, why – you know, as we say in the business school, you know, never give a sucker an even break. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's like – that's chiseled over the door, by the way, in Latin so that not everybody can understand it. And so, but some of these insurance designs say we'll pay up to the insurance company or the employer will pay up to this much, and if you choose a more expensive one, you pay the difference yourself. It's called reference pricing. And in the reference pricing, which is now being applied for surgery, but also for drugs, then you just see the consumers, they really go for that lower cost because they're saving their own dollar rather than the dollar of the insurance company. So I think we'll actually see more insurance designs which say, we'll pay up to X, we the insurance company or the employer or Medicare. We'll pay up to X, and if you choose the more expensive, and X covers a lot of stuff. I mean, it covers most of the stuff, but if you cover the Deluxe, then if you want the Duke, then you pay the difference yourself. It's like, employer, if you travel, if you work for the University of California, you are in university business, they say we use the federal government per diem, we'll pay hotel up to X. If you choose the Four Seasons, which is above X, that's fine, but we'll still pay X. We won't pay nothing. We'll pay X, and you pay the difference. And it's your choice. I think we'll see more of that.
Have those designs been shown to save money, have an impact on outcomes, or anything else we know?
Yeah. Yes. First of all, oh my God, do people switch their behavior if they're spending their own money? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after that, how do the providers respond? If there's enough of this going on, they do bring their prices down because they want to sell their stuff, their mm-hmm. services, or their product. And then the effective outcomes are very hard to study. That I studied personally, been looking at procedures more, such things as arthroscopy of the knee or cataract surgery of the eyes. And we've been working on colonoscopy as a diagnostic colonoscopy. And there the evidence is that these designs really reduce costs and the quality of care is basically the same.
Okay.
It doesn't really have. So, which if you're a wonk, that says, oh, we've improved value because lower cost, same quality, that's increased value.
Right. On the surgery side, there may be some greater opportunities than on the drug side in terms of finding appropriateness, so forth, too, because cost sharing is widespread. As you report, it's growing. It is a pretty blunt instrument to try to change behavior.
Yeah, no. If we were designing a healthcare system, we wouldn't start with a whole lot of consumer cost sharing. I mean, that's not the place we would start. Mm-hmm. But we live in the United States of America, and so that's what we're doing.
Great. We are out of time, so we are going to close here. Please hold your applause for just a moment. Our thanks to UC Berkeley Professor Jamie Robinson for his comments today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening to the recording. I'm Mark Zitter, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.